Welcome to Mayo Clinic Pharmacy Grand Rounds, a weekly podcast for pharmacists, physicians, physician assistants, and nurse practitioners who are interested in learning more about clinical pharmacology topics. I'm your host, Garrett Schramm, Director of Pharmacy Education and Academic Affairs at Mayo Clinic. To claim pharmacology CE credit or to get a copy of presentation slides, visit ce.mayo.edu/pharmacypodcast. Since 1981, there have been over 520 probiotics introduced to the consumer market, making it almost impossible for providers to keep up with all of the different options that patients use. Regardless of your practice setting, patients commonly inquire about these probiotics, but well-designed clinical trials to assess their safety and efficacy have not been available. Today, Dr. Jennifer Adama, an internal medicine clinical pharmacist at Mayo Clinic, will identify the different strains of bacteria found in probiotics, discuss target populations for use, and weigh in if probiotics are safe in elderly and immunocompromised patient populations.
Thank you for the introduction. The term probiotics has gained popularity with many healthcare and diet fads in the last several decades. In fact, in the early 2000s, use of probiotics increased 120% from 2002 to 2012. Looking at the total probiotics market in terms of supplement as well as foods that contain probiotics, it was valued at $6 billion in 2008. And then just last year in 2009, the supplement market specifically was valued at $3.2 billion. And then since 1981, there have been 524 new probiotic products that have been on the market. And so because of this increasing popularity and increasing use with our patients, as healthcare providers, we need to be aware of both the safety concerns as well as some of the efficacy data that's available with probiotic use. My objectives for this presentation are for you to be able to identify different strains of bacteria found in probiotics, to discuss some populations that we might want to target for probiotic use, and then finally to discuss the use of probiotics in some of our higher risk patients, such as the immunocompromised population. First, looking at probiotics as a whole and giving some background into their use. A little over 100 years ago in 1907, this is when the first probiotic theory was proposed by a scientist, Metchnikoff, that proposed that if we have some pathogenic bacteria, there might be some beneficial microbes that could overcome those pathogens in our GI tract. Then later in 1917, this is when the first strain of a probiotic was isolated. And it was isolated from a soldier during an enterocolitis outbreak who did not develop the disease. And so it was thought that this particular strain would be beneficial. Then looking at 1935, this is when the first commercial probiotic was on the market. It was a probiotic-containing drink that contained a lactobacillus species. So like I alluded to, there are multiple different strains that can be included in probiotics and may be beneficial for our patients. And so it's essential for us to know if these different strains should be evaluated separately or if they should be just grouped together as a whole. Looking at some of the background into if we were to evaluate a probiotic and just go to our supermarket and look at a probiotic bottle, what should we be evaluating? So this is an example of a supplement section of a probiotic Culturelle that contains a lactobacillus species. And so I'd like to direct your attention to the outlined dose of that lactobacillus species that is posted as 40 milligrams or 10 billion CFUs. And so the term and the unit CFUs is used quite a bit in probiotics, and this stands for colony forming units. It's known as the number of viable cells that our patients are ingesting when they're taking this probiotic. Looking at some other common probiotics, from left to right on this table, the brand names are listed there. So some common brand names, Culturelle, True Nature, Florastore, Align, and then BioK Plus. That next column then are different strains that are included in these probiotics. And so some of them have just a singular strain, like Culturelle, just the lactobacillus strain, while others contain a combination of different strains. That middle column is important to us because this is the strengths that are available with these probiotics. And so like I mentioned previously, we'll see the term CFUs used quite a bit with these probiotics. What's also important to note is that some of these brands do come in multiple different strains, and some of those higher CFU counts are marketed as high dose or high strength probiotics. So what's important for us to know is there a benefit with using a higher dose? Because what typically comes with that higher dose is associated with a higher cost as well. So we want to be able to justify that cost for our patients. The next column then is looking at storage requirements. This is more important in our outpatient setting since some of our probiotic brands do require refrigeration, and this is important to note if our patients do not have access to refrigeration. And then that last column is also important looking at different adverse effects. And so probiotics in general are thought as pretty benign agents, and so some of the more common adverse effects that we'll see would be bloating, gas, and abdominal pain. However, these can be somewhat muddled because sometimes we're using probiotics for GI indications, so it's difficult to really pinpoint are these adverse events coming from probiotic use versus the underlying indication. Now, since 1907, I'd like to say that we have nailed down one particular mechanism of action for all of our probiotics. However, unfortunately, we still have just many different proposed mechanisms for why probiotics would confer a benefit. And so I have some of them listed here, one being modulating cytokine activity, having to deal with some of the inflammatory markers in our GI tract, potentially a benefit there. Also competing for nutrients or competing for adhesion with different pathogens. This goes back to that first original theory that we could have beneficial microbes that would overgrow more pathogenic microbes. And then lastly, probiotics might scavenge radicals or modify pathogen-driven toxins, and so not necessarily overgrowing the pathogens, but making them a little less toxic for us. Now this brings me to my first assessment question. So which of the following strains is most commonly found in probiotics on the market? Escherichia, Lactobacillus, Clostridium, or Bifidobacterium? So as we have some more answers coming through, I would have to say that I agree with the overwhelming response here that Lactobacillus is most commonly found in probiotics on the market today, as indicated by some of those common probiotics that I pulled out. A lot of them contain the Lactobacillus species. Escherichia might be contained in some probiotics, however, it's not as commonly seen. Clostridium would not be found in probiotics, so that would not be the correct answer. And then Bifidobacterium may be found in probiotics as well. It's also common, just not seen as commonly as a Lactobacillus species. Moving in to look at some of the efficacy data that we have available for our probiotics. What's difficult with probiotics is that in the last 10 years, over 1,500 trials have come out comparing their efficacy in many different indications and disease states. So this can be incredibly overwhelming for us to digest this information and really find a target for probiotic use. And so what I've done is touched on some of the guidelines that either mention probiotics or conditionally recommend probiotics in different indications. So the first guideline is the American Gastroenterology Association, and they set up two different camps for probiotics. So one being that there's no recommendation because we just don't have the data there to support probiotic use. And so these would be Crohn's disease or ulcerative colitis remission, abdominal pain associated with IBS, or C. diff treatment. However, they have this other side where they might recommend probiotics if we use particular strains for these disease states. So the one that I'll be focusing on for this presentation is the prevention of C. diff. Also throughout this presentation, I'll use a couple different terms and I'd like to differentiate between the two of those. So antibiotic-associated diarrhea is something that we're familiar with for our patients. There's a 5 to 30% risk of patients who are on antibiotics for developing antibiotic-associated diarrhea. And this can occur while patients are on antibiotics, but also have the potential to occur up to 2 months following the cessation of antibiotic therapy. So a pretty big time frame for this to occur. It's thought that this occurs due to secondary disruption of normal flora, and this goes back to that very first proposed theory that we could have toxic pathogens that overcome the GI tract. Looking now at C. diff-associated diarrhea, it is a subset of antibiotic-associated and makes up about 10 to 25% of these cases. When patients have developed C. diff, there's a 20% rate of them developing it again, so it puts them at a higher risk of developing it. And then the scary thing about C. diff is this prevention to a severe disease state, which is pseudomembranous colitis. So this is what we really are trying to prevent for our patients. So we can target patients based on some risk factors that they may have. And so this is for antibiotic-associated and C. diff-associated diarrhea. Patients are at an increased risk if they are critically ill, if they are immunosuppressed either with a disease state or on immunosuppressive medication, if they have a prolonged hospital course, and then, of course, some medications. So antibiotics specifically, within that class being amoxicillin plus or minus clavulanic acid, cephalosporins, and then clindamycin. Looking at what our C. diff guidelines then say about probiotics, since this could be a potential area for their use, IDSA's most recent update in 2017 stated that there are insufficient data at this time to recommend administration of probiotics for prevention of C. diff outside of clinical trials. So this goes against what our AGA guidelines recommended earlier. And so what I've tried to do is then pull out some of the data for those particular strains that AGA did recommend and see if there really is strength behind that data for us to go and want to use probiotics then. So the first trial I'll be looking at is a trial evaluating Saccharomyces boulardii species, otherwise known as Florastor as the brand name. They included patients who were aged 50 years or older and had been on antibiotics for less than 48 hours. They did exclude patients who had diarrhea at time of admission, as well as patients who had a regular intake of probiotics prior to admission. The intervention was that Florastor probiotic, like I mentioned, versus placebo, both of those taken twice daily throughout the antibiotic treatment and then 7 days following. Baseline characteristics were similar between the two groups, a mean age of about 80 years old. Something this trial did do is they included patients who had IBD or IBS, as well as patients who were immunosuppressed, which is not something that we'll see with all probiotic trials. However, just looking at the percentage of patients that they included, it was a very low percent. They also teased out patients who had been on greater than one antibiotic, since this may put patients at an increased risk. And then the mean duration of antibiotics was about 10 days. Looking at the outcome results then, for antibiotic and C. diff-associated diarrhea, there was no difference seen between the Florastor group and placebo. And there was also no difference seen in mean onset of antibiotic-associated diarrhea, but I would like to point out that the mean onset for the two groups for placebo was 16 days and for Florastor was 36 days. So this does support the fact that we might take several months for us to see the development of antibiotic-associated diarrhea. Some strengths that I identified in this study is that they had a clinically significant primary endpoint. So they did have, their endpoint was greater than 3 loose bowel movements in 2 days. They also categorized the antibiotics that patients were on by risk. So they did include patients who received any antibiotic, but they did break that down into high risk, medium risk, and low risk, and made sure that there were equal numbers between the two groups. Some limitations, however, is that they did have lower than expected incidence of antibiotic-associated diarrhea. And so going back to their original power calculations, the study was actually underpowered from that. And then while they did say that they did not exclude immunosuppressed patients and patients with IBD and IBS, there was such a low percentage that I would not feel comfortable applying this data to that population. So my final conclusion from this study is that Florastor was not shown to decrease incidence of antibiotic or C. diff-associated diarrhea. Looking at another strain that is recommended by AGA, it's a lactobacillus combination species, also known as BioK+. So patients were included if they were treated with a penicillin, cephalosporin, or clindamycin for 3 to 14 days, so one of those high-risk antibiotics that we touched on. And then they were aged 50 to 70 years old. They were excluded if they had active diarrhea or a GI disorder, so that would include IBD or IBS, if they had had C. diff within the prior 3 months, and then if they were on immunosuppressive therapy. That intervention was the BioK Plus probiotic, like I mentioned, and this study actually evaluated the different doses that are available for BioK Plus. So we're able to see, is there a benefit with that higher dose? They continued their intervention through antibiotic therapy and then 5 days following. For their baseline characteristics, the mean age was a little younger than the prior study, so about 60 years old, and the mean antibiotic duration being 8 days. They also made sure that the penicillin, cephalosporin, and clindamycin percentages were equal between all three groups. For outcome results, both antibiotic and C. diff-associated diarrhea were statistically significantly lower in the low-dose and high-dose groups, so seeing a difference versus placebo in both that one capsule of BioK Plus and with the two capsules. There was also a difference seen in the mean duration of symptoms, where it was lessened in the groups who did receive probiotics in both low-dose and high-dose. Some strengths of this study, like I just touched on, is that they did evaluate different doses, so we are able to see if there is a benefit for suggesting a higher dose or a higher strength product for our patients. They also had a required length of hospitalization, so patients had to be hospitalized for 5 days, thus putting them at a higher risk of developing antibiotic-associated diarrhea. Some limitations, however, is that they defined antibiotic-associated diarrhea if it occurred within 24 hours of antibiotic administration, but we know it might take up to several months to even see antibiotic-associated diarrhea develop, so there could be quite a few cases that the study wasn't able to catch because of that definition. They also had higher than average rates of antibiotic and C. diff-associated diarrhea than what have been seen in previous trials and what we see in practice. So a quarter of their patients who received placebo ended up developing C. diff, which is much higher than what's seen in other trials. My final conclusion for the study is that BioK Plus did show a reduction of both antibiotic and C. diff-associated diarrhea with both their high and low dose. Now, here at Mayo Clinic Rochester, we have a couple internal medicine providers who preferentially choose BioK Plus as a probiotic. So I thought it'd be prudent to pull out some of those trials and see the data specifically for BioK Plus. So there are three randomized controlled trials that have been published evaluating the use of BioK Plus. That first one on the left-hand side is the one I just went through, where they evaluated the different doses and did see a reduction in incidence and length. That middle trial had an N of 400 patients. They also saw that incidence and length of antibiotic-associated diarrhea was reduced. However, they just compared that lower dose, so still saw the benefit with the lower dose of 50 billion CFUs. And then that final trial did have a smaller N, so about 90 patients. They saw incidence of antibiotic and C. diff-associated diarrhea reduced, and they compared the lower dose. And this was actually their probiotic-containing drink, so it would be an option for our patients who either can't tolerate or would prefer not to take a capsule. So my overall conclusion for BioK Plus is that it has shown a reduction in antibiotic-associated diarrhea in multiple clinical trials, which is more than what we can say for a lot of the probiotics that are on the market today. The final efficacy study that I'll look into is another dose-response study, and it evaluated the probiotic Hawaru Restore. They included patients who were on antibiotics for 3 to 14 days and had been hospitalized for at least 5 days. Patients aged 30 to 70 years were included as well. They excluded patients presenting with diarrhea, patients who had had antibiotic therapy within 30 days prior to admission, and then patients on immunosuppressive therapy. That intervention was the Restore probiotic, so a few lactobacillus species as well as a bifidobacterium species, and evaluated a low dose, high dose, and placebo, so similar to the previous study that I just went through. They continued the intervention through antibiotic treatment as well as 7 days following. Baseline characteristics were similar between all three groups. Something this study did is they did break down antibiotics for a shorter duration for 3 to 8 days versus antibiotics for 9 to 14 days and made sure this was similar between all three groups. The mean age was a little younger, so 50 years old in this study. And then the use of penicillin, cephalosporin, and clindamycin were similar between all three groups. For outcome results looking at antibiotic-associated diarrhea, there was a significant lowering in the high-dose group. However, it was not significant in the lower-dose group. So only seeing a benefit with antibiotic-associated diarrhea in that high-dose group. For C. diff-associated diarrhea, this was reported as percent of antibiotic-associated diarrhea. So it looks like high-dose and low-dose have the same percentage. However, keep in mind that that's the percent of their antibiotic-associated diarrhea cases. So in reality, the low-dose group did have more cases. And so for C. diff-associated diarrhea, the high-dose probiotic did show a benefit versus placebo, while again, that lower dose did not show a benefit. Some strengths of this study is that they followed patients for 4 weeks following antibiotic therapy, and so hopefully catching some more of those antibiotic-associated diarrhea cases. They also included those patients with high-risk antibiotics, so targeting that higher-risk population. Some limitations of this trial is that while they did break down in their baseline characteristics patients who were on a shorter course of antibiotics and then patients who were on a longer course, they didn't analyze the primary endpoint on these stratifications. So we still don't know if there is a benefit seen more so with a longer course of antibiotics versus a shorter course. They also had poor adverse event reporting, where they lumped all adverse events together and didn't tease out any study drug-related adverse events. So some, such as headache or fever, that we might associate with probiotic use were lumped together with things such as an arm fracture, a runny nose, and arrhythmias. So things that we wouldn't think were caused by our probiotic use, and so it's difficult for us to say what adverse events were really due to the probiotic use. My final conclusion for Restore is that at a higher dose, it reduced the incidence of both antibiotic and C. diff-associated diarrhea. Looking back at all three trials in summary, that first trial evaluating Florastor did not show a benefit in antibiotic or C. diff-associated diarrhea. That second study evaluating BioK Plus did show a benefit with both high-dose and low-dose BioK Plus. And then that final study looking at Restore, evaluating different doses, however, the high-dose product was the only one that showed a benefit. This takes me to my next assessment question. So which of the following probiotics could be used at a lower dose to reduce the incidence of antibiotic and C. diff-associated diarrhea? BioK Plus, Florastor, Restore, or Culturelle. As more answers are coming in, I would agree that BioK Plus is the probiotic that can be used at a lower dose to reduce the incidence of antibiotic and C. diff-associated diarrhea. Florastor only comes in one dose, so it was not compared with multiple doses. Restore did not show a benefit with the lower dose in that last study that we evaluated. And then Culturelle has not had a study that compared the multiple different doses available. Now that we've gone through some of the efficacy data that's out there, it's also important to weigh the risk for our patients. So looking at both safety and cost that would be associated with probiotic use. Like I mentioned previously, probiotics are generally thought as benign agents. And so looking at those three studies specifically that we went through, the safety and adverse events that were reported, so that first trial just had one line that said no difference in abdominal pain or constipation seen between the two groups. That second study evaluating BioK Plus did note that lower rates of abdominal pain and constipation were reported in the probiotic group. However, this was not analyzed on a safety analysis scale. And then that last study, Restore, like I mentioned previously, they had multiple different non-study related adverse events that were reported, so it's difficult for us to assess which were due to the probiotic. And so since adverse event reporting can be so poor in these probiotic studies, I've turned to a meta-analysis to help group together some of the limited adverse event reporting data that we have to see if there is a difference between probiotics or placebo. So there was a Cochrane review performed a couple years ago in 2017 that looked at 32 randomized controlled trials and included 8,300 patients and looking at adverse events that occurred between the probiotic group and control group. What they found is that there was a significant difference in those two groups in that there was a lower number of adverse events that were reported in the probiotic group. However, the Cochrane Review did note that there are some studies with a higher bias versus studies with a lower bias. So just pulling out those particular studies that have a lower bias risk, that included 14 randomized controlled trials and about 5,300 patients. And seeing in the adverse events reporting, when pulling out that low bias group, that there was no difference between adverse events in probiotics versus control or placebo. And then this Cochrane Review took another step, and they recognized that in a lot of these trials, it ranged from 2 to 44% of missing data in terms of adverse events in these trials. And then that can be quite significant. And so what they did for the missing data to account for that, they said for patients who that were missing data, we'll have a 1.5 to 1 ratio of adverse events for those patients. And so would that skew our data at all? And so using that ratio of 1.5 to 1 and including all of the patients in the trial, there was no difference seen in adverse events between the probiotic group and control. And then this Cochrane Review took one step further and said, okay, worst case scenario, if the missing data, there were 5 adverse events in the patients that were missing data and had a 5-to-1 ratio, would there be any difference? And they found that there was no difference then in probiotic group versus control group. And so what we can gather from this meta-analysis is that probiotics either have a beneficial profile in terms of adverse events in these studies, as shown by that top line, or there's no difference. So it further supports the thought that probiotics have a minimal risk of adverse events in our general population. However, it's important to keep in mind who was excluded from these trials originally. So a lot of these trials did exclude patients who were elderly and then patients who were immunosuppressed. And these are really our populations that we're more concerned about using probiotics in. So what I've done is pulled a few case reports in these particular populations to assess probiotic use in these patients. So looking at that first case report on the left in blue, this was a patient who was status post-kidney transplant on immunosuppressive therapy, was treated with antibiotics for a different infection and ended up developing C. diff, so was started on the Saccharomyces species FluroStore probiotic, and then a few weeks later had a Saccharomyces species growing in their blood culture. That next case report in pink was a patient who was newly diagnosed HIV, who had not been started on antiretroviral therapy yet. They were also being treated for a different infection with antibiotics and ended up developing C. diff, so was started on the FluroStore probiotic, and a few weeks later, again, seeing the Saccharomyces species growing in their blood cultures. And so a few things that I'd like to point out with these first two studies is that going back to those AGA guidelines, they recommended conditionally the use of probiotics for the prevention of C. diff. And in both of these patients, it was used as the treatment of C. diff. However, I did include them because it does show us the use of probiotics in an immunosuppressed population. And then this final study was a patient who was 89 years old and had no relevant past medical history except for recurrent UTIs. And she'd had one episode of C. diff prior. And so she was started on treatment for a UTI and prophylactically started on FluroStore. And then after a week had blood cultures positive for a Saccharomyces species. And so she would have been excluded from those last two trials that we looked at who had a cap age of 70 years. And so from this data, it makes me very hesitant to use probiotics in both the immunosuppressed population as well as the elderly population. One, because we have a few case reports suggesting that we might see more serious adverse events in these populations, but also all three of these patients would have been excluded from those efficacy trials. So we don't know if we can even apply that information to these patients. Another point that's interesting to note in the risk category of probiotics is looking at cost and what the cost would be associated for our patients. So looking back at those common probiotics on the market, their cost per day ranged from 20 cents up to over a dollar. So keeping this in mind, when patients could be on antibiotics for a couple weeks and then were continuing probiotics for another week after that, this could go up to $30, $40 for our patients, depending on the brand of probiotic that we recommend. It's also important to note if we're inpatient, if we even have access to the probiotic that we would want to recommend for our patients. And so I've pulled out whether or not these probiotics are stocked here at Mayo Rochester, but it would be important to know and figure out which probiotics are stocked at whichever institution you are at. There was also a cost-benefit analysis that was performed evaluating if the cost of a prophylactic probiotic on the healthcare system would be greater than or would be less than if a patient ended up developing C. diff. And so for this graph, on the x-axis is the baseline risk of C. diff in percentage, and then on the y-axis is the relative risk of C. diff if probiotics are used prophylactically. And so depending on the baseline risk versus the risk with probiotics, it determines whether or not the use of probiotics is economically favored. And so ultimately what they found is that generally there is a benefit seen with probiotics when the risk of C. diff is greater than 1.7%. They also were aware that different strains cost different amounts for our patients, so they did see that lactobacillus species were economically favorable over a saccharomyces species. So this brings me to my final assessment question. So which of the following probiotics should be avoided in immunocompromised or elderly patients? Thiocate Plus, Florastore, Restore, or Culturelle? Okay, well, answers are coming in. I would agree with the majority that Florastore is the one that should definitely be avoided in our immunocompromised and elderly patients. However, you could argue that we should be avoiding all of these agents since they haven't been extensively studied in those populations. And so what do we take from all of this information? So we have some efficacy data, we have some safety data as well. How do we synthesize this and then take it back and apply to our patients? And so while I wish I could stand up here and give you an ideal patient in which we should always use probiotics, that's just not feasible. And so instead, what I thought would be more helpful is to give then some factors that you would want to consider if you're starting a patient on antibiotics. And so I've listed just a few here, but there could be many more that are included on this list. So looking at risks of developing antibiotic-associated diarrhea, some different patient-specific factors, as well as antibiotic factors. So length of hospitalization, of course, being at a higher risk of developing antibiotic-associated diarrhea if you have a longer hospitalization. Looking at duration of antibiotic therapy, a lot of these studies looked at antibiotics that were used for 3 to 14 days. So is it really applicable for our patient going home with a PICC line and 6 weeks of antibiotics if we send them home with probiotics as well? Looking at the antibiotic that was chosen. So those more high-risk antibiotics are ones that I would target and want to consider probiotics more for those patients. Looking at patient age, since we saw that there might be more serious adverse effects with the elderly population, but also seeing that there was a lower range that was included on those efficacy trials, so 30 or 50 years old, and so evaluating if it's necessary to have a probiotic. Patient acuity is also an important factor. So something I didn't mention was that those studies, all of those patients were admitted to a general medicine floor. And so for our ICU colleagues, this might not be as applicable. And there is some data that shows for different indications that the use of probiotics in our more critically ill patients would not be beneficial. Looking at if patients had a history of antibiotic or C. diff associated diarrhea, since that might put them at an increased risk. And then finally, if patients are in an immunocompromised state, either from a disease state or from immunosuppressive medications, it may not be prudent for us to use probiotics since it might put them at risk for more serious adverse events. And so I'd like to finally conclude with probiotics with lactobacillus strains may be more efficacious at preventing antibiotic-associated diarrhea. And to note that there are key patient-specific factors that I would like to evaluate before considering probiotics in patients. And then that probiotics containing Saccharomyces boulardii should be avoided in those immunocompromised patients. And thank you so much for your attention. And at this time, I'll take any questions.
If you enjoyed this episode and want to hear more, subscribe using iTunes or your favorite podcasting app. Thank you for listening to Mayo Clinic Pharmacy Grand Rounds. Join us weekly for more exciting clinical pharmacology topics.